you're going to map out carbon or you're going to map out biodiversity conservation, it's got to be done in the context of empowering local communities to do so. And it got them in the room with really high level policymakers from internationally as well as in Indonesia to shine a spotlight on getting land rights and making the case that, you know, local communities and these systems, these ancestral systems and these community-based resource management regimes are really, really the key to conservation, especially in the context of rapid palm oil expansion in Indonesia and, you know, a lot of forests being converted into plantation lands.
Welcome to Data Dialogues, a podcast that brings together multiple perspectives to look at a single issue. This season, we are looking at Indonesia's One Map policy, a decade-long ongoing effort to resolve land conflict with data. We're also looking at the limitations of modern cartography and indigenous struggles over being seen, struggles that assert we were born here, we're living here, and we'll die here. I'm your host, Madhuri Karuk. In this episode, you're hearing from folks you've already met in episode one. Journalist Bagja Hidayat, social scientist Micah Fisher, policy advocate Anne-Sophie Gindrose, and two new voices, political ecologist Irendra Rajawali and scholar Rini Astuti. Together, we're digging deeper into the post-Suharto era in Indonesia and the political conjuncture that created the perfect set of conditions for One Map to emerge. In the introductory episode, we took you through this really high-level overview of why Indonesia's One Map initiative emerged in the early 2010s, right, as the result of a very particular political conjuncture that, you know, had these global as well as country-specific trends. That moment prioritized data transparency as something that urgently needed to happen, both for resource management as well as for local accountability. The roots of the One Map actually goes back decades in Indonesian history, but it also has this really clear linkage with how Indonesia was super important to global environmental institutions and multilateral bodies. Everyone was betting on Indonesia as, you know, this potential bulwark against climate change. And that was because of its rainforest, especially peatlands, with its ability to trap greenhouse gas emissions. And Indonesia became a key player in the climate financing ecosystem designed by bodies like the COP and, you know, UNFCCC, the World Bank. And to understand how Indonesia got to this point, we have to take a short detour back into the 1970s.
In 1970s, President Suharto gave the license to the big companies to manage the forest. And the result is 64 million hectares forest managed by the big corporation. That's now, we know that more than 30 million hectare forest is destroyed.
Pak Bagja is a journalist with Indonesia's Tempo magazine, and he's been covering environmental issues in the country for the last two decades. So when he's saying that forests were destroyed during President Suharto's tenure, he's actually alluding to something even bigger. So Sukarno was Indonesia's first socialist president after the country gains independence from the Dutch in 1945. And Sukarno pursued a policy of protectionism, right? He was limiting foreign investment and wanted to protect Indonesia from outside influence. But Sukarno was overthrown by the new order regime of President Suharto. And that's the moment Pak Bagja is referring to.
Because he want to deliver the legacy to the development. He make some regulation to the natural resources management with the omnibus law, job creation law. He want to make an invitation to the investor from the board to easy doing business with the law. But this is the big challenges to the our environment, because with the make easy doing business for the investors based on the natural resources management, this is threat to the our environment, especially forest. Indonesian people has big challenges how the regulation manage the forest and how to protect the our forest that has destroyed with the past regulation in Suharto administration. So that is the problem in Indonesian natural resources management right now.
Suharto's rule was rooted in an extractive model of development cemented by state repression. Political ecologist Irendra Rajawali reminisced about this time with me.
Back then, Indonesia's, I would say, political situations was pretty rough. We were governed by a military dictator that was in Indonesia for more than 30 years. So I was still a student. So besides studying, I was also part of the student movement or people movement, if you want, to get rid of this dictator. I lost some friends. Using the word lost means we don't know where are they. They were kidnapped and probably killed.
Repressing dissent was a key element of President Suharto's authoritarian New Order regime. And that's because he was pursuing aggressive foreign investment and opening up the country's natural resources to extractive foreign capital for logging, for plantations, especially palm oil and rubber. And during this time, multiple rounds of mapping for forest management using satellite data did not actually alleviate border disputes or resolve overlapping concessions. And these maps, unsurprisingly, showed a complete lack of engagement with how forest dwellers actually managed and used and claimed land. Even more egregiously, the size of forest-dwelling populations who actually lived off a forest remained a mystery. Sure, customary law or adat was officially respected until it came into conflict with public interest. And public interest was always left undefined and kept as broad and opaque as possible. Just as mapping was taking off in Indonesia alongside this opening up of territories to foreign investment for resource extraction, this was happening globally in the Colombian and Brazilian Amazon, in the Philippines, in Thailand. There was a growing interest among communities in using maps as a tool. So if governments map lands to identify resources on that land and manage that land between communities and corporations, or the overlapping claims that might emerge between communities and corporations, the motivation to map from the perspective of communities is not that different, right? Because communities also want to delineate their rights to land and protect their claims to land and resources. And this inclination to map, to foreground community land rights, this reached a groundswell in Indonesia after Suharto's New Order government fell in 1998.
Late 1990s, you had Suharto fall from power, a system of governance of democratic decentralization put in place. And all of a sudden, these initiatives of mapping and making claims were able to gain that much more traction.
That was environmental social scientist Micah Fisher, and he's based at the University of Hawaii Manoa's East-West Center. In Indonesia, international conservation organizations like WWF and IUCN, they were supporting mapping initiatives as part of their larger mandate to improve natural resource management. And the idea was that by triangulating GPS data and already existing official land use maps with local understandings of forest resources, what you'd get ideally would be improved outcomes for conservation as well as local livelihoods. And this was a part of that growing global interest in community mapping in the 1990s that I've already talked about a little bit. And that's when mappers were beginning to think of maps not just as tools of representation, but also a mode of communication, right, that could offer up alternative definitions of territory. And by the 2010s, community mapping was evolving even further, what came to be called crisis mapping, with crises like the Haiti earthquake in 2010 and the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. You were seeing mappers, you know, crowdsourcing data in real time. The question then quickly became, could community maps become official maps? And how are communities and governments going to reconcile their competitive perspectives of a given territory?
This story really takes off in 2007 when the UNFCCC meetings were held in Bali, and there was a lot of attention on climate change, especially on REDD+.
With REDD+, or the Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation Framework, a strong argument came to be made about the positive linkages between climate mitigation, biodiversity conservation, and Indigenous people's rights. So REDD+ was this policy instrument where wealthy governments in the global north had effectively figured out a way to outsource climate responsibilities to Indonesia. The idea was simple. Global North countries were going to pay Indonesian villagers to not deforest. And maps were going to be a key part of REDD+ implementation. And Indonesian local communities were quick to spot an opportunity here. Because if the Indonesian government was going to commit to unifying its existing very convoluted system of 85 overlapping thematic maps into a single database for the sake of implementing REDD+, well, then now was the time for communities to insist on integrating their land rights, so their maps, into that same database.
And I think the NGOs community in Indonesia was really strategic to say, you know, if you're going to map out carbon or you're going to map out biodiversity conservation, it's got to be done in the context of empowering local communities to do so. And it got them in the room with really high level policymakers from, you know, internationally as well as in Indonesia to shine a spotlight on getting land rights and making the case that, you know, local communities and these systems, these ancestral systems and these community-based resource management regimes are really, really the key to conservation, especially in the context of rapid palm oil expansion in Indonesia and, you know, a lot of forests being converted into plantation lands. So the ability to have this high level attention on participatory mapping, getting people to look at land and making sure that there was authority for local communities to manage them was really the context for that happening.
So local communities got into the room by saying, hey, you can't map carbon and you can't map biodiversity hotspots without acknowledging and mapping our land rights too. Dr. Rini Astuti talked to me about why this was such a crystallizing moment from the perspective of civil society organizations in Indonesia and their insistence on unifying spatial data with social reality.
It was important at that time to be able to see how much of land that are still being forested in order to be able to see, you know, the carbon stocks and who own this forest and who will get the benefit from the payment from Red Plus and so on. So at the time, there is this political conjuncture of the Constitutional Court decision number 35, the one map policy that was initiated a year before in 2011 that sees the importance of spatial data to address the messiness of forest governance in Indonesia. And then the last one was the Red Plus Readiness, which was a big program supported by United Nations, big donors that then provide financial and political support for civil society in Indonesia to be able to then use this donors' funding to support communities, especially indigenous communities, to then do this counter mapping. That's, I think, the background of why then it become very popular and among this civil society and indigenous communities that then use this counter mapping processes and supported by all this political conjuncture.
We've talked a little bit about decision number 35 in episode 1. And how it acknowledged indigenous people's right to land, right? And it set off this nationwide push to map and demand recognition of these territories and the resources on these territories as something that belonged to the community as a whole. Now, here's the catch. The process of territorial recognition in Indonesia is tied to a larger process for recognition of indigeneity itself. Let's hear from Anne-Sophie Gindros, who you've already met in the first episode.
You know, in Indonesia, the way is very long and very complicated for indigenous community to get their rights recognized, because before they can claim anything in terms of territory, land or forest, before that, they need first to be recognized as an indigenous community. So they need to have first their legal status as an indigenous community recognized by the government. And this is done through a local regulation, usually at the district level or a region decrees, meaning that these are the local authorities who are in charge of this first step to recognize the community. Sometimes they go further, they recognize the community and they recognize also the territory. As soon as you enter in a process where you want to assert your rights, you want to be recognized as the owners of the rights, tenure rights on your land, on your forest, on your natural resources, you need to establish first your status as a legal entity, if you want. So the community has to be recognized as an indigenous community, because this is a precondition to be able to claim the object, which is the indigenous land or indigenous forest.
So in other words, to get your land recognized as belonging to a certain community, you first have to prove your belonging to that community. And this is really important to distinguish here, which is that this process of recognition, it's very, very different from seeking concessions for, say, logging or applying for a license to set up a plantation, right? And there you can just go and pay for that concession or license. But with the process of seeking recognition, you as the community have to provide proof.
And you know, the way the community have to provide the evidence that they are an indigenous community, it's quite complicated actually, because they need to provide the evidences that they share a common identity, they have a common history, they have a customary law, they have a customary institution, they have a territory, and they still live and manage their resources according to their customary laws. So, you know, it's a lot of documentation that needs to be brought by the community to get this recognition as an indigenous community. The map is only one element. The map, you know, it's about providing the evidence that you have a territory. But it's only one. You have to provide so many other evidences. And this makes the whole thing very complicated because you have to go through a real, you know, political process. You have to lobby the local parliament. You have then to lobby the head of the district. And of course, you come across other interests, right? There are competing interests on the same land, on the same resources. So yeah, it's really, really complicated.
Most of this complicated recognition process plays out at the local district level. So once a community is recognized as indigenous, it can start mapping its territories. Usually a community will reach out to a civil society organization, you know, that has the mapping know-how. The organization comes in, it offers training in mapping technologies, supports the community, right, in facilitating conversations about their land, you know, the consultation process with elders. And over the course of, you know, at least 4 to 6 weeks, you have sketch maps that start to take shape. And it's these sketch maps that are then submitted to the district government for verification. And if verified, these maps get incorporated into the official version.
Once a community is moved, you know, they will lose their connection with their environment, with their territory, their identity. And then, you know, all the customary law will be very weak and the institution will become very weak. And then, you know, you go into a process to try to reclaim your land. And you have to kind of provide the evidence, you know, that things that have been actually destroyed, weakened because of governmental decision, you know, granting concession or establishing a national park or whatever. The fact that they are in a weak position is resulting from government decision, but they have to go back to the same government to prove that they still exist.
And I will, you know, emphasize this point again, that what's basically a really straightforward process for palm oil companies, right? The process of getting a license to start cutting down rainforests for planting rows of oil palm. The process for communities to gain recognition and then start creating their maps and submitting those maps for verification, this is all very long and drawn out, right? Because they have to prove that they're indigenous, right? They have to build that evidence, create the maps, and submit their paperwork to the district level government. And it's only then that you have the evidence gradually beginning to move up from the district level to the regency level, then the provincial level, and then finally the national level one map database. And of course, all subject to approval at each stage of the process. As Dr. Rini Astuti put it to me,
participative mapping is not just simply, for example, an individual in a forest community, for example, adding names to the forest or adding name to the rivers that are not being included yet in the government site. Participative means that the process of creating this spatial data has to come from a political process of understanding that this is the rights of the community, that this process has to be equal and participative, and then that the community then comes together to understand that this is their territory, and then going through an advocacy process.
So in this episode, we gave you a sense of the political conjuncture in which one map came to be. This local demand for mapping to be seen coincided with a global environmental regulation framework called REDD+, that also required lots of local level data to succeed. Communities saw their chance and seized it. kicking off a surge in community mapping initiatives. So in the next episode, we will meet Jeka Pepe or Jaringan Kerja Pemetan Participatif, Indonesia's nodal community mapping network. And Jeka Pepe does precisely this work of shepherding community maps to official recognition through this, you know, very complicated bureaucracy. We'll talk to several members of Jeka Pepe's national secretariat in Bogor and how their work has evolved in the last 30 years, even as their core emphasis on bringing social and spatial data together has remained the same. To get more information about this episode, including a transcript and show notes, or to join the conversation, head over to our website, openenvironmentaldata.org, or follow us on social media at openenvirodata. This podcast episode was created by Madhuri Karuk,
Michelle Chirupka,
Lena Silasan,
Sahil Ansari,
Sally Kwan,
and the team at Open Environmental Data Project. With theme music from the Papuan Voices documentary and other music from the Blue Dot Sessions library. Data Dialogues is a project from Open Environmental Data Project, where we are building spaces to grow the global conversation on environmental data access and use.